This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, neurologist Oliver Sacks, has explored perception, memory, and consciousness through best-selling books, including Awakenings, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and Musicophilia. His new book, Hallucinations, draws on history, literature, and the patients he's treated, patients who've experienced hallucinations brought on by neurological disorders, brain injuries, medications, fevers, blindness, and other causes, hallucinations that range from the terrifying to the transcendent. One chapter, called Altered States, is about his own experiences with mind-altering drugs in the 60s when he was a neurology resident. These drugs connected with the reason he wanted to be a neurologist, which was to study how the brain embodies consciousness and the self, and to understand its amazing powers of perception and distortion. Terry spoke with Oliver Sacks last Tuesday.
Dr. Oliver Sacks, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's good to be with you again.
In our previous interview 2 years ago for your book, The Mind's Eye, about visual disturbances, you had a chapter about losing vision in one eye because of cancer. And you wrote in a footnote, in the 60s, during a period of experimenting with large doses of amphetamines, I experienced a different sort of vivid mental imagery. And we talked about that a little bit because I was so surprised that such a big revelation that you'd taken large doses of amphetamines was confined to a little footnote. But now your whole book is about hallucinations, and there's a whole chapter about the hallucinatory drugs you took when you were young. So at the beginning of your chapter about your own experimentation with altered states, you write, every culture has found chemical means of transcendence. At some point, the use of such intoxicants becomes institutionalized at a magical or sacramental level. What are you thinking of there?
Well, I was thinking of peyote ceremonies with Native Americans, but similar ceremonies in Mexico with morning glory seeds with Ololuqui, similar ceremonies in Central America with magic mushrooms, similar ones in South America with I can't pronounce it, Ayahuasca. And so this seems to happen in every culture at some point.
And you're right that some drugs, like hallucinogenic drugs, promise transcendence on demand. Is that why you wanted to experiment with them?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons. It's probably a little too high sounding for all of my reasons. I think I sometimes just wanted pleasure. I wanted to know what it was like, and I think there was always an observer part as well as the participant. I would often keep notes when I got stoned.
What did it seem absurd to you to keep notes on the experience, because the experience was so heightened and can be so absorbing to take notes on it brings you outside of it while you're in it, which can seem absurd in that moment?
Yes. Well, I didn't always take notes on it. I especially tended to take notes, I think, if a trip turned frightening, and then the taking notes would help me stand outside this in a way.
Mm-hmm. What was the first time you tried a drug that induced perceptual distortions?
I think it was in 1963. I was in Los Angeles at UCLA doing a residency in neurology, but I was also very much on the beach, on Venice Beach and Muscle Beach. And there was quite a drug culture, as there was also in Topanga Canyon, where I lived. And one day, someone offered me some pot, and I took two puffs from it, and I'd been looking at my hand for some reason, and the hand seemed to retreat from me, but at the same time getting larger and larger until it became a sort of cosmic hand across the universe, and I found that astounding.
So what did you find most interesting, pleasing, or disturbing about that first experience that made you want to seek more experiences like it?
I was fascinated that one could have such perceptual changes, and also that they went with a certain feeling of significance and an almost numinous feeling. I'm strongly atheist by disposition, but nonetheless, when this happened, I couldn't help thinking that must be what the hand of God is like, or how it has experienced.
Were you already a neurology student?
Yes, I was a neurology resident at that time. And the air was buzzing with discoveries and talk about neurotransmitters and drug actions and what one could do for people with psychosis or people with Parkinson's. And so the chemistry of the nervous system was a very hot topic. And in inviting one to try for oneself.
So you started taking LSD in 1964, and you write that you took mind-altering drugs every weekend for a while. Give us a sense of one of the better experiences that you had that made you want to keep using it.
Well, a particular experience was with a color. I'd been reading about the color indigo, how it had been introduced into the spectrum by Newton rather late, and it seemed no two people quite agreed as to what indigo was. And I thought I would like to have an experience of indigo, and I built up a sort of pharmacological launch pad with amphetamines and LSD and a little cannabis on top of that. And when I was really stoned, I said, I want to see indigo now. And as if thrown by a paintbrush, a huge pear-shaped blob of the purest indigo appeared on the wall. It again had this sort of luminous, numinous quality. I leant towards it in a sort of ecstasy. I thought, this is the colour of heaven. I thought, maybe this is not a colour which actually exists on the earth. Or maybe it used to exist and no longer exists. And all this went through my mind in 4 or 5 seconds. And then the blob disappeared, giving me a strong sense of loss and heartbrokenness. And I was haunted a little bit when I came down, wondering whether indigo did exist in the real world. And I would turn over little stones. I once went to a museum to look at azurite, a copper mineral, which is maybe the nearest to indigo, but that was disappointing. I did, in fact, have that experience again, but when I had it the second time, it was not with a drug, it was with music. And I think music can take one to the heights in a way comparable with drugs. But I think the indigo was my favorite hallucination.
So give us an example of a really bad time that you had on a hallucinogenic drug.
Well, I think the worst time was also a rather puzzling time. It was in 65. I was new to New York. I was sleeping very badly. I was taking ever-increasing doses of a sleeping medication called chloral hydrate. And then one day I ran out of it. But I didn't think much of this, though when I went to work, I noticed I was rather tremulous. And that time I was doing neuropathology, and it was my turn to slice a brain and describe all the structures, which I usually enjoyed doing and did easily. But this time it was difficult, and I hesitated, and I felt my tremor was becoming more obvious. When the session was over, I went to have a coffee across the road, and suddenly my coffee turned green and then purple. And I looked up. There was a man paying at the register, and he seemed to have a huge proboscidean head like a sea elephant. I was panicked. I didn't know what was happening. I ran across the street to a bus, got on it, but the people on the bus terrified me. They all seemed to have huge egg-shaped heads with eyes like the eyes of insects, compound eyes, which move suddenly. I wrote all this in my journal. I felt that I would get dangerously out of control one way or another, either with panic or catatonia or whatever, unless I made a note. And I somehow managed to get off the bus and onto a train and get off at the right stop, though when I got off, I lived in the village then, as I do again now, the houses, the buildings were flapping like flags in a high wind. When I got back to my apartment, I phoned up a friend of mine. We'd interned together. Her name was Carol Burnett. And I said, "Carol, I want to say goodbye. I've gone mad." And she said, "Oliver, what have you just taken?" And I said, "I haven't just taken anything." And she thought for a moment and said, "What have you just stopped taking?" And I said, "That's it, the claw." And so this was the beginning of an attack of the DTs, the delirium tremens, not induced by alcohol withdrawal, but by claw withdrawal. It's a dangerous state. I should really have checked myself into hospital, but I didn't. I thought I wanted to go through it with some kindly medical supervision, and I did. But there were many, many terrifying things there.
Was it helpful while you were having these nightmarish hallucinations because of withdrawal from the medicine that you were taking? Was it helpful to know that there were medically induced hallucinations, that you weren't losing your mind and that this was going to end?
Yeah. Absolutely. When I realized it was medication and not madness, that was a relief so huge that I felt I could sit through the rest of it.
As a neurologist, what did you learn from that experience?
I learned that one shouldn't be silly. In particular, from that experience, there were all sorts of particular odd visual perceptions. Sometimes I could not see continuous motion. I would only see a series of stills. And that fascinated me very much. And it made me, in fact, wonder whether the sense of visual motion is an illusion, whether, in fact, we see a series of stills. I don't think I'd had that thought until I was seeing stills. I mean, I felt that almost every possible sensory combination was offered to me. Every fantasy, every dreamlike distortion. And with hallucinations, one remembers them, unlike dreams. And on the whole, they're not like dreams, because in dreaming you're asleep, you're only a dreaming consciousness, whereas here you're awake and observing yourself.
So just another experience I want to ask you about here. You write about how your parents were both doctors, and once while they were out of town, you raided their medicine cabinets and injected yourself with morphine to see what that would be like. And I was wondering if they ever found out.
I don't think they found out. And if they did, they didn't say anything. That was a one and only time when I raided their medicine cabinet, and also when I tried morphine IV. The experience was both was intriguing in a way, but it also lasted, to my shock, for 13 hours when I thought it had only lasted for 20 minutes. And it made me realize how dangerous the opioids were.
Did it affect how you prescribe morphine as a doctor?
Well, I don't prescribe morphine too often. In general, I act as a consultant, and I may suggest various medications without myself prescribing them. But I think that morphine is indispensable for very severe pain. In England, for that matter, they use heroin, and I think that to deny morphine, say to people with terminal pain, on the ridiculous notion that they may become addicted to it is the height of cruelty. I think there are times when morphine is needed.
Now, I want to ask you about visual migraines. And
yes.
I want you to describe the kind of visual distortions that people with migraine often get.
Well, the most characteristic one starts as a brilliant scintillating zigzag, which expands over the course of a few minutes and becomes a huge crescent, which looks rather like a medieval fort. And this is sometimes called a fortification pattern. It is extremely bright, and there may be an area of blindness around it. It takes something between 15 and 20 minutes to develop and disappear, and this is precisely coincident with a wave of electrical excitement crossing one's visual brain, one's occipital cortex. Sometimes there are more complex things in a migraine. For example, Siri Husted has described and written about how on one occasion in a migraine aura, she saw a little man and his ox about 6 inches high on the ground. She had this Lilliputian hallucination which charmed her, and this again lasted a few minutes and then vanished. One can, in fact, have almost any sort of hallucination with migraine, including hallucinations of smell or hearing or music, though the commonest ones are visual. And I would say there are 100 visual migraines for anything involving another sense. If you're lucky, you don't go on from the visual migraine to the headache and nausea. I'm lucky that way, I don't. But my mother, who had this, would have the whole thing.
Do you still get visual migraines?
Yes, I got a particularly strong one after watching the Book of Mormon.
You're not blaming it on the show, are you?
No. It was simply for me. I think it's a brilliant and funny show, but for me it was a huge sensory overload. It was much too bright and much too loud. And so I think this was my brain objecting to it.
So what patterns do you see when you have a visual migraine?
I usually get the zigzag, but I may also see lattice patterns, like tessellations. Sometimes these lattice patterns seem to cover people's faces or piece of paper I'm writing on. I mostly get complex geometrical patterns. I've never actually visually seen images with migraine, although on at least two occasions I've had a smell, in particular a smell of hot buttered toast, with a strong sense that I was about of being 3 years old, being put in a high chair and about to be given some hot buttered toast. A sort of olfactory hallucination often goes with recollection in that sort of way. The first time I got that, I was in hospital and I went searching for the toast. The second time, I was driving along the Bronx River Parkway, where there was obviously no toast to be had.
You write in your book Hallucinations about an auditory hallucination you had that really might have saved your life. You were mountain climbing, and you'd injured your foot or your leg, and part of you just wanted to just, like, slow down, sleep. But then you had heard a voice which said what?
The impulse to sleep, I'd torn off most of the thigh muscles and the knee was dislocating backwards, and at one point I got quite shocked and thought it'd be nice to have a little sleep, and the voice said, no, that would be death. Go on, you've got to keep going, find a pace you can keep up and keep it up. And this was a very clear, commanding voice. It was a sort of life voice, and it was not to be disobeyed.
And so you kept going in spite of the horrible shape that your leg and knee was in?
I was sort of rowing myself down with my arms. I'd splinter the leg as best I could with an umbrella stick and my anorak, which I tore in two. Incidentally, I thought that was going to be the last day of my life, and it had every prospect of being, but I was found at twilight by two hunters. This was in North Norway. But that voice was crucial for me, and I've heard many other stories like this. One of them was from a young woman who was broken-hearted after a love affair and determined to commit suicide, and she had a bottle of sleeping tablets and a tumbler of whiskey to wash them down, and she had raised the tablets to her mouth when she heard a voice saying, "Don't do that. I wouldn't do that if I were you. You won't always be feeling the way you're feeling now." And it was a man's voice. She didn't recognize it. She was very startled. She said, "Who was that? Who was that?" She said a figure materialized in a chair opposite her for a few seconds, a figure in 18th century dress, then vanished. But she feels that hallucination saved her life. And I think her story is not that uncommon, nor mine for that matter.
Whose voice did you hear? Was it your voice, a stranger's voice?
Not my voice. I often hear my voice. I'm always sort of cursing or muttering to myself. But this was a very clear, assured voice, not a voice I recognized, but a voice I trusted, and which I suppose I realized came from some part of me, because there's no other place it could have come from.
What do you speculate goes on neurologically when, in a state of extreme danger like you are in, a voice tells you to do the thing that you need to do to save your life?
It seems to me almost like an ultimate safeguard, some power or propensity which is sort of built into the structure of the mind and the emotions. Probably, I would think most people would go through a life and never hear it. It only announces itself in extremity.
Well, Dr. Sachs, it's just such a pleasure to talk with you. You're always so interesting. I thank you so much for coming back to our show.
Well, thank you so much.
Oliver Sacks speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Sacks is the author of the new book, Hallucinations. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Two of the year's most highly anticipated movies have just opened in theaters. Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, and Skyfall, the third Bond film starring Daniel Craig and directed by American Beauty Oscar winner Sam Mendes. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
Two icons, Abraham Lincoln and James Bond, make triumphant appearances this week in movies with more in common than you'd expect. True, Lincoln is a titan of history, liberator of slaves, and as such, an adversary of Western colonialism, while 007 is an outlandish stereotype embodying white male Western authoritarian power. But the makers of these films do a sterling job of testing their respective subjects in front of our eyes before pronouncing them fit to carry on in our collective imagination. Steven Spielberg's Lincoln begins in a way that subtly alludes to the Lincoln Memorial. We see him first from above and behind. He's reviewing the troops and gazing down on a pair of black soldiers. Like us, they're in awe. But then one of them challenges the president on the grounds that they're paid less than whites, and Lincoln is suddenly more man than monument. He doesn't have a good answer. Tony Kushner's script is based in part on Doris Kearns Goodwin's book Team of Rivals, which focuses on Lincoln the politician. Here, the war is all but won. Now the challenge is getting Congress to pass the 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery. You say the Emancipation Proclamation did that? Ah, but that was an executive order in wartime. Lincoln needs a law. On a late night in the military's telegraph office, he learns the operator is an engineer in civilian life, prompting a meditation on Euclid.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works, has done, and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is, even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law, it is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
It's hard to believe that light, cracked voice belongs to Daniel Day-Lewis. It's a running joke that Lincoln will launch into an illustrative anecdote at the drop of a stovepipe hat, and the actor lets you taste Lincoln's pleasure in choosing each word. He captures Lincoln's famous private sadness, as well as the ability to shake it off and become a master politician who knows when to compromise and when to go to the mat. This is the Lincoln we don't know as well, the one who made his rival for the presidential nomination, William Seward, here played by David Strathairn, his Secretary of State, the one who could come down off that pedestal and bargain. Is Lincoln the movie as great as Daniel Day-Lewis's performance? Oh, yes. The shop talk around passing the 13th Amendment is a bit thick in the early scenes, but all goes swimmingly once Seward engages a lively trio of lobbyists, played by John Hawkes, James Spader, and Tim Blake Nelson, to descend on Congress, dispensing threats and rewards. Tommy Lee Jones, eyes sagging under a thick locked toupee, has the show-stopping part of abolitionist Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, who's counseled to hold his famous temper and misrepresent his anti-racist beliefs for the sake of the vote. The movie makes you root for his, so to speak, white lie, because politics for Lincoln was about passing laws by hook or by crook. Director Sam Mendes's Skyfall also shows its hero from a different angle. Mendes has a cheeky attitude toward James Bond's old and new, toward the conflict between the traditional Bond established by Sean Connery and the rough, hurting, rather self-indulgent persona of Daniel Craig's Bond. Mendes and co-writer John Logan are old Shakespeare hands, and they play up the Coriolanus-like reluctance of Craig's 007 to do what's expected of him, to don the tuxedos, take his martinis shaken, not stirred, and commit himself unreservedly to Queen and country. Craig's Bond is disillusioned with Judy Dench's M, that mother hen all too ready to sacrifice any one of her chicks for the good of the mother country. But in the course of Skyfall, Bond and we have to make peace with her less-than-humanist regime, which has produced in ways I won't reveal a psychotic super-cyber-villain named Silva, played brilliantly by Javier Bardem. The filmmakers run out of invention in the last act, but until then, this is an unusually funny, literate action picture with a cavalcade of glorious stunts and a shocking punchline. Each familiar trapping has been inspected, reconceived, and pronounced fit for duty, and the myth of Bond is mightier than ever.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Skyfall has just opened in theaters, Lincoln in select theaters. More after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Many of our guests have told their coming out stories, and many of those stories were about the difficulty of coming out to parents who didn't approve of homosexuality. Today we have a coming-out story from the perspective of the parents of a gay child, parents who assumed their son was gay by the time he was around 4 and who were fine with that. But they still couldn't spare their son Joe from being bullied at school and from teachers and administrators who didn't understand. And their support wasn't enough to prevent him from trying to commit suicide after he came out at school. John Schwartz is the author of the new memoir, Oddly Normal. He describes it as a book about raising a gay child in the age of Tyler Clemente, Proposition 8, and Glee. Schwartz is also a national correspondent for The New York Times. Terry spoke with Schwartz and his wife, Jean Mixon, Joe's mother, last Monday.
John Schwartz, Jean Mixon, welcome to Fresh Air. You suspected your son was gay when he was really young. How young?
Three.
Okay, so
yeah,
it was young.
it was pretty young, but he was pretty out there.
Yeah.
What do you mean by out there?
Well, it's a kind of funny story. His grandmother suspected he was gay. She showed him a couple of shirts. That one was pink and one was, I guess, blue. I don't know. And she asked him which shirt he'd rather wear. And he picked the pink one and she said, ah, he's gay. And it was little things like that. Like we took him shoe shopping and he picked the pink shoes with the light up lights. And
the rhinestones.
And the rhinestones. And when he was four, he played with Barbies exclusively. Ken was thrown out. And he dressed them for hours. And since we had our son Sam, who played with trucks and, you know, threw all the Barbies out of the way to get to the trucks, we pretty much suspected, at least, that...
That there was something going on with Joe, there was something a little different about Joe.
So you suspected he was gay when he was three or four, but it raises the question, what does it mean to be gay when you're presexual? Because even if a child has sexual feelings at that age, it may be a purely physical feeling and not be linked to another person or another gender.
Well, it's not that these were even sexual feelings necessarily, but it was a sense of what team you're on. I don't know if I'm really going to get that across right, but even at the age of, I think Joe said it was about 6 or 8, he recognized that he was far more interested in boys than girls. In fact, he went online and saw this word, homosexuality, and he looked up what it meant. And what surprised him was to discover that boys are supposed to like girls.
And he had a crush on one of Sam's friends when he was 5. And so he had, you know, sexual feelings even then, even at that young age.
And when did you find out about this, recently or when he was 5?
Oh, about the crush?
Yeah. And about looking up, you know, finding the word homosexual on the internet and realize, that's me, yeah.
Right. That came out while we were working on the book. As we were finishing up the manuscript, I said to Joe, well, when did you know? And he told us the story about going online. And there have been other discussions we've had, but that was the first time he really laid out when he knew.
So you're pretty sure he's gay when he's really young, like 3 or 4 years old. You know, he wants the shoes with the rhinestones and the pink things on them. And you're fine with this. He's playing with Barbies. You're fine with that. But then he's going to kindergarten. And Gene, I think it was maybe you who's thinking like he shouldn't be taking the Barbies with him for show and tell. That might not be a good idea. So when he started to have more of a group life, going to school, what didn't you want him to take to school and what were your concerns about what would happen if he did?
My concerns were that the other kids would tease him, that they wouldn't understand, and that he wouldn't fit in. And it's really important in elementary school and even in middle school, they're very conformist ages. And if you don't fit in, you get teased and ridiculed. And as it turned out, even with taking the Barbies away, he didn't fit in. He wasn't like the other children. But I wanted to give him a chance to be as much like them and to be able to fit into the social group if possible. And I knew that taking a dressed-up Barbie as a boy to kindergarten was going to set him apart and he'd never have that chance, that no one would ever forget it.
How did you explain that to him?
Oh, I didn't. I took all the Barbies, I threw them in the toy box, I put the toy box in the attic and just disappeared them. And I felt terrible about it for a year. He was looking for, you know, they were his favorite toys and he was looking for them and he was saying, well, what happened to them? So I don't know. They just disappeared.
And at what grade did Joe start running into problems at school because he was different from the other kids?
Oh, first grade. Kindergarten was wonderful. His teacher was wonderful. She loved him. He was able to read long, complex books at age—he started reading at age 4. And by the time he was in kindergarten, he could read Harry Potter. He could read anything he wanted to. And so the kindergarten teacher just let him sit off to the side and read while the other children were learning how to read. The first grade teacher was not flexible at all. And she was upset when he would disappear into the books and check out of the curriculum. And so she, because she was not flexible with him, she kept fighting with him. And we found that teachers who were confrontational with him brought out, he has some social problems with knowing how to let things just go by. And so as she became confrontational, he became more combative. And that's when we started to see real problems with him.
And meanwhile, by early in elementary school, you saw the boys and girls starting to differentiate. And so while the boys could talk at length about the Giants lineup, Joseph didn't know anything about that, couldn't talk about it. He was much happier with the girls. Over time, the girls determined that boys are yucky and they want less to do with them. And so Joseph found himself sort of in the middle and isolated.
Your son was labeled with a lot of different disorders in his early years in school. There was the GTLD, gifted and talented, but learning disabled. He was diagnosed as being on several different levels of the autism scale. What am I leaving out?
Oh, well, there was ADHD. There was a teacher that suggested ADHD, at least one. Another teacher thought, you know, he seems bipolar to me. There were people who suggested, as you're saying, Asperger's and other elements of the autism spectrum. And none of them thought that he was just Joe. They were all looking for a label to pop on him.
Were you concerned about having him labeled, or did you think maybe one of those labels fit and maybe it would be helpful to have not only a label, but a diagnosis, and therefore the possibility of addressing a problem?
What we were told at the time was that if he had Asperger's, there was nothing that could be done anyway. There are therapies that they could engage in, but there really wasn't much they could do. And at the time, they said, and he will never change. He will always be the same. As it turned out, it has been explained to us more recently that the understanding, I guess, of Asperger's has changed, and that they say that the children can improve to the point where they fall out of diagnosis and they're just considered quirky. And at the same time, it's been explained to us that having the diagnosis of Asperger's helps him, because if he behaves in the classroom in a way that is outside of the norm, he has the school therapist on his side, and she can say he's classified and he doesn't get punished according to the school handbook.
So it seems to us that the community of people who deal with this has gotten a more flexible approach to this than in those early years. And the attempt to just pop a label on a kid and isolate him, which is what it seemed that people were trying to do early on, became a more nuanced approach to helping Joe later. And so it took us a long time to get there. And there was a lot of confusion and conflicting opinions from people in the therapy community. One therapist would tell us, he'll never get better. He'll never go to college. He might never even be able to go to summer camp. Other therapists have said, he's on his way out of this diagnosis. Through adolescence, I think that he'll be just fine. But when the professionals conflict in this way, what are we supposed to do? We don't have the advanced degrees.
One of the things you did as a parent, John Schwartz, is before your son actually came out to you, but you were pretty confident he was gay, you looked through the browser on his computer, the website browser, and you wanted to see what sites is he going on. Why did you do that, and did part of you say to yourself, this is an invasion of privacy?
The part of me that might think that also said, I'm the dad. And I've written about internet privacy. I've written about privacy issues for the papers I've worked for over decades. And while I believe privacy is important, I think parenting is the overriding value. And so I've always checked the kids' browser histories. I've always checked to make sure that they're not communicating with people they shouldn't be communicating with, and to sort of just sort of watch what they're doing. I don't then sit them down and say, oh my God, I can't believe you're looking at that. I just want to make sure they're not getting in trouble. And as long as they're not getting in trouble, I don't have a problem with it. But looking at, say, the older brother's browser history was great preparation for looking at Joe's, because the older brother, at the age of, 12, 13, was looking at pictures of naked people. Joe's browser history...
When you say naked people, you mean naked women.
That's exactly it. The older brother, Sam, was looking at naked women, but when I looked at Joe's browser history, he was looking at naked men. And up until then, I had been saying, well, a kid can be a little flamboyant, he can seem gay, but you never really know. But browsers don't lie.
How did he come out to you, or I should rephrase that and say, how did he more or less come out to you?
Joe and I were spending more time walking around, going to dinner together. Jean was saying to me, Joe needs dad time. Joe needs time with you. And so we were making sure to take walks to get ice cream together and head to restaurants. And so one night we're in a sushi restaurant in our town, and Joe was telling me about how as the seventh grade year was nearing an end, he was freaking out the other kids a little bit. He was saying in school to another boy, does Bill know just how attractive he is? And he said that this would, freak out the kids a little bit, and a kid would say, well, Joe, are you gay? And I said, well, Joe, what did you tell him? He said, oh, I don't say anything. I just let them wonder. I said, okay, but are you telling me you're gay? And he said, well, I might be. And so we had a little more food, and I said, this thing that you're not telling me, is it all right if I tell your mom? And he said, okay. And he was out.
Was that a relief to you?
Enormous. Enormous. Jean and I were just quietly celebrating at home, like, we did it! All the groundwork. He's launched. It's fine. We're good.
Yeah, but things weren't so good afterwards. I mean, it was fine for you and the family. Once he started to come out at school, things got worse.
Things were falling apart, in fact. It was good for us, but at school, it was the end of the year, always a tough time for Joe, a time of transition. The school at the end of the year was sort of falling apart. Our school district keeps going into almost into summer, and they didn't have anything for the kids to do. There was a flu epidemic going on, and classes were just basically kids sitting around talking to each other. So there was no structure, and so things got a little more dicey. And meanwhile, Joe was dealing with really dark thoughts and was having a really hard time. And I said, well, you're not in therapy right now. We can go back into therapy. We can help you if you want. And he said, no, I'm dealing with it. And so against the backdrop of school sort of falling apart, Joe was under more pressure. The coming out hadn't made him calmer. And at school, he was building toward this explosion. And one day, he blew up at some of these boys and said, you're always making these comments and you're rating girls. Well, I'm going to rate you. You're a 5. You're a 7. You're 3. And this unsettled the boys tremendously. And they actually went to one of the school administrators and complained that Joe was bullying them, was intimidating them. And so that was the day that Joe came home and tried to hurt himself.
Yeah, that's the day he came home and took an overdose of pills. And Jean, you were the one who found him. How did you discover that your son had tried to overdose?
Well, I was working as a crossing guard at the top of our block. So I saw Joe every day after school come off the bus. And when he got off the bus that day, he didn't look right. He looked blank. He looked wrong. And I couldn't get home until 4:30. So when I got home, he was locked in the bathroom. And I heard him talking about books falling off shelves. His voice was slurred. It sounded like he was on drugs. And I thought, well, he couldn't possibly be on drugs. He's not social enough to score any drugs. And I eventually got him out of the bathroom and rushed him to the hospital. It turned out he'd taken an overdose of Benadryl.
What message did his suicide attempt send to you, his parents?
That his life had to change immediately, that he could not continue, that something had to change or he would end up back in the hospital again. And what we did was we contacted the Gay Center and checked out their teen programming so that when the next school year started, he would be with other gay people and that he would be in a social group and they have counselors. He needed to be in a setting where he could be a gay person without judgment. And that's what the Gay Center teen programming provided for us.
Once he was out, it was possible to tell him that he was not alone. And once he was out, we were able to get him to the youth services at the Gay Center where there was therapy, counseling, and other kids. And we also, for the first time, were able to send him to theater camp. He was set to go to theater camp. And that's another really supportive environment for a kid who's gay. He wasn't unusual there. And so all of a sudden, a world opened up to Joe.
How is he doing now? He's 16. He's in high school. How long has he been out? How many years has it been?
Well, it's been about 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when Joe came out and found his community, it opened him up. And this level of stress that we'd always felt was there diminished. It was like draining a pool. And everything's not perfect. He's still emotionally vulnerable. Every day isn't great, but he's got friends he hangs out with. He has activities. He sees his buddies. He hugs them. He's having more good days. And so the story isn't over, but the book has a happy ending because things are good.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. John Schwartz, Gene Mixon, thank you both.
You bet. Thank you.
John Schwartz and Gene Mixon speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Schwartz's new memoir is called Oddly Normal. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.